This is an interview with Mrs. Catherine Epps for the Youngstown State University 150th Anniversary of Poland's United Methodist Church by Wilfredo Rivera at 113 Massachusetts Avenue, Poland, Ohio, on May 18, 1981 at approximately 7:15 p.m. Mrs. Epps, when was your father born and your mother, and what are some of the stories you recall about your family's past?
My father and mother were both born in Michigan. My father in Allegan County. Well, they were both born in Allegan County and met in Allegan when they were young. And I remember living there myself until I was 7 years old. It was a charming little town on the Kalamazoo River. And I had two brothers, one older and one younger, Bob, the older one, and Phil, the younger one. And I remember a very happy childhood in this small town. And then when I was seven, we moved to Muskegon, Michigan, which is on Lake Michigan. And that was an excitement to me and to all of us to live on the big lake. And we had so many happy times there because within 10 miles there were seven lakes. So we were always able to go swimming someplace. And we all went to school there in Muskegon. And we all three went to the community college following high school. It was a two-year college, and there was one of us in there each 2 years for 6 years. And then the boys went on to universities, and I concluded my education there by taking a secretarial course. And
what kind of work did your parents do?
My father was a printer. He worked with a newspaper. In fact, he was the foreman of what they called the back room, running the presses, and he was an expert on linotype machine. And my mother was just a hardworking, loving housewife who very much enjoyed her family and her greater family, her relatives, and enjoyed entertaining and cooking and taking care of all of us.
What year did you relocate to Poland?
when I came to Ohio was in 1940. I came to visit an uncle whose wife had just died. He had come down here from Michigan, too, and had lived here and worked in the Sheeton, too, for many years. And I met a man, so I stayed. And we didn't get married right away, though, because and then I went to work for the Prescon Steel Company. And that was just when World War II broke out. So he was in service for 4 years and went directly overseas, so we weren't married till he got back. And then we stayed here, although part of the time while he was in service, I was back up in Muskegon. But then we stayed here after we were married. Except for the first year when he was still in service, we were down in Richmond, Virginia. Then, and we bought a home over on the south side of Youngstown. And our daughter was born. And when she was about 4 years old, we had a chance to move out to Poland. We just thought the schools would be better for her, too. So we bought a home in Poland. And that's when we joined the Poland United Methodist Church, soon after that. And Patty wanted to go to church, to go to Sunday school with the kids she played with in the neighborhood. And she went visiting several times while we still belonged to Westminster Church downtown. But then we followed suit and we all joined in 1955. And then that was early in the year of 1955. And then in the summer, when my husband died, the minister thought maybe I ought to work for the church. So he asked me to, and in November I started working for the church. And I've been there ever since.
Who was the minister who hired you?
Norman M. Parr, his name was. And he's the only one that isn't living. He just died just a few months ago. He was wonderful to me. Seemed as if whenever I needed somebody to talk to, there he'd be at my back door, come in and have a cup of coffee with me and talk. The parsonage was right behind us in Massachusetts. I lived over in Delaware Avenue then. And a year later, I realized I needed a much smaller home that was pretty large to hang on to, and just the two of us. So that's when I finally found this little house and moved in here. So I've been here 24 years.
This Reverend Park, can you tell me a little bit more about his background?
Yes, he had been there 4 years already. And he was a well-loved minister. And was so kind, so good to me. And his wife and son Timothy were neighbors of ours too, so that made it very nice. He had come here from, well, he'd been in the Youngstown area. He had been a minister at Hubbard, and he had been associate minister at Trinity Church in Youngstown before he came here. And after he left here, he went on to be a district superintendent in the Methodist Church.
Approximately, how many members were there to the congregation when he was
about minister? About 500 at that time, I would say.
Who succeeded Reverend Parr?
M. Dean Marston followed Reverend Parr. He and his wife, Grace, and two daughters, Anne and Sally, moved into the parsonage, and they became good friends of ours too. And he had been here not quite a year. He had been here about 9 months when the church burned on April 1st, 1957. I suppose you've heard that date before in these interviews. And I remember so well the kind of a day it was. It was just a cold spring rainy day. And we stood over there across the street and watched the firefighters. And it was a sad thing. A lot of the people were crying, and it was a very difficult time. I wasn't working that day. It was a Monday, and at that time I didn't work on Mondays.
Just prior to the burning of the church, what were some of the activities that the members of the church did in order to raise the money for charity purposes or to help the church out financially?
We did a number of things, like having the women did things like having soup sales at noon and bake sales. And especially one thing I remember they're doing is making apple butter outside over a great big fire and one of those huge kettles, and they'd take turns stirring it in a long wooden thing, just like you see pictures of that they did years and years ago. And they would sell that, and the people in the church were very active people, and the young people were too. They had their camps, and they went to Lakeside, Ohio, for a summer camp. Lakeside is sort of a Methodist Chautauqua, and it's a place that most of us Methodists who have been there feel very nostalgic about. It's a recreational area as well as a religious area.
Was your church involved with other churches in the community? Would they all get together? And
mostly the Presbyterian Church, because the Lutheran Church that's here now and the Holy Family Catholic Church weren't here at that time. So it was really the Presbyterian and the Methodist churches. And they did join together. We had a vacation Bible school together, for instance. And we had our Thanksgiving service. It was usually a morning service at that time. And we would have that service first in one church and then the other. And one of the things I particularly remember about in those early years was the wonderful church picnics we used to have. We used to have them in Columbiana, Firestone Park, all those early ones that I remember. And they were great. Everybody went. More than now, you know, I mean a larger percentage of the congregation.
Can you tell me a little bit or describe the church before it burned down, the structure?
Oh, yes. We have such a beautiful picture of that church in our parlor in the new church. It was stone and gray, and it had a bell tower, which they had a bell in it that they rang every Sunday, and it was one of the things that was prized as a job to ring the bell. And it was, but that had been rebuilt so that the sanctuary faced in a different way than it had previously, as I understand it. But it was a lovely, homey kind of a church. And just before that, in 1950, an addition had been built on for educational purposes, and that is still what is standing in the bank, back of the bank now, the Union National Bank. That part didn't burn, so that didn't have to be torn down. But the sanctuary and the office that I worked in was under the sanctuary. And the kitchen that was down there and the Sunday school rooms down there were all pretty well ruined by the fire. It went right up through the roof, too. And we stayed there a while. I remember April being one of the coldest Aprils I ever remember, and it rained most of the time. And I was in that office, freezing, and the only heat was just an open gas stove. And I remember wearing boots and heavy socks and shoes and coats all the time I was working for all that month of April. But just before, on March 26th, just before the April 1st of the fire, we had bought the house next door. We had planned, we had known that we must enlarge. So we had planned to buy that property and property behind us, which we never did get. But we were very lucky to have bought that house next door, so we moved the office over there. And the minister's office was the living room. My office was the front bedroom, and then where we did the mailing and the address graph and so forth was in the back bedroom. And then downstairs, it was a pretty old-fashioned basement, but that's where the women cooked to put on suppers and so forth. And I suppose some of the people have told you about how we started Canfield Fair Project about then. These women did the cooking for Canfield Fair down in that basement. And we had a very big tent out there, which became much bigger each year. We did it for 11 years. And the whole project became bigger every year. But this first year, when they were cooking down there, then they'd have to, the people who were delivering the food out to the Canfield Fair would walk up and down those awkward old basement steps. And where I was, in the office, just outside of my door, was one of these great big registers where all the smells from downstairs would come up, and I'd just about die all the time with all that food, you know, being cooked there. And even before we started the Canfield Fair Project, and during that time, there were a group of women, we called them the Susie class. It was really Susanna Wesley class, but we called them the Susies. And they baked pies. And they became pretty famous for their pies. And before they were through doing it, they had baked 65,000 pies there, and after we moved into the church,
who
they
made
kept
up this
on.
Group?
They were women. I wish I had all the names. Should I give you some of them?
I would appreciate it.
Yeah. Minnie Kenny was really one of their leaders, and Mabel Miller, and Carrie Tinney, and Mrs. Little and Mrs. Siegel and I can see her but can't think of her name. Oh, there were many others. I wish I had all their names because I hate to neglect anybody. Edith Myers. And so many others, and they took orders for pies, and they baked them for organizations that had meetings and everything, you know. And they kept on until they had baked 65,000. They kept track all the time of how many they were making. And this Canfield Fair Project. I was reading in a little bit of history this afternoon. The first year we made about $3,000 cleared on it. That was pretty good for the times. And besides, we had bought a great deal of restaurant equipment, good stainless steel cabinets for salad cabinets and for hot storage of hot things, you know, and so they invested a great deal of money into it too that first year, and that increased until they were making $8,000 and $9,000 most years after that. We finally, when we voted to stop, I think we'd worn out We were just, it took about 350 people to run the operation. And a lot of the people took their week's vacation and donated that time to that project too.
How involved were you with this project?
I was sort of in the middle. being secretary, there was a lot of just keeping things running, you know, a kind of a coordinator, I guess you'd say. And between, and the phone lines were going all the time between the tent out there and the church, and then helping supply workers that they need here and there, and call people to give a little bit more time here and there. And then when Saturday and Sunday would come, then I'd go out to the tent and work and serve on the serving line too, because that was always fun. And the part I remember best, it was after it was all over, it would be Labor Day, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, they would have just taken down the tent and just dragged everything that was left over back to the church. And everybody'd go home and just die. And I'd come back to work the next morning and face all that leftover food and piles of aprons and dish towels and everything to be sent to laundry, you know, and all kinds of things to be sorted out and things to be put in the freezer and sold. That leftover food was sold and so forth. And so I always remember that part so well. And I wasn't sorry to see that end.
Who would you say was instrumental in implementing this project?
It was called the Methodist Men's Fellowship at that time. They really started it. And then the Women's Society of Christian Service was the name of the women's organization at that time. And they did it together, although the men really were the ones that started it. And their president at the time was Chester Dahlman. And Chet was a wonderful leader in that sort of thing. And all the way through, he was really the chairman of the fair. And oh, there were so many of the other men who worked so hard. Paul Fryman was our treasurer all during that time. And that just took endless amounts of work. He was another one who would take his vacation at that time. He's still our treasurer. He hasn't always been all through those years, but he's our treasurer now again and has been for quite a while. And then Chester Dahlman's wife, Arlene, worked so hard and gave so much time. Well, most of the people did. The people, you know, as in any church, the people who are the active ones really got into that and worked. But one of the best things about that whole project wasn't the money we made. It was the fellowship. And all through the years, people would say, oh, I know him. I got acquainted with him at the fair. We worked together. And I think that was one of the best things for developing a close fellowship with our people. In fact, the fire was. It's funny to say that, but I think the fire was kind of a shot in the arm. There's something that melds people together when you have a disaster that you have to work for. And needing a place to worship, you really have to work together and plan together. And when we decided to build a new church, people, volunteers came from every place that were willing to help in their way. And then after we got started and the church was pretty well built, there were so many finishing jobs that people could do. And we used to go over there and spend lots of really enjoyable evenings painting or scraping paint off windows or washing windows or doing all kinds of things and yelling back and forth and just having a good time out of it. It really was. And of course, being Methodist, we always had to drink coffee and eat pies. And we enjoyed all that. And for 8 years there, Reverend Marston was here. He was here longer than any of the other ministers I've worked for. And he was here 8 years. And it was during most of the fire, you know, the episode of the fire, and then of building the new church and getting it started. And we burn April 1st in 1957. I guess I kind of go around circles here a little bit. But we were in our new building to use it for the first service in June 22nd, 1958. And that was really good for the size building it is, you know.
Where were the services held?
Well,
right after the fire.
We had an opportunity to use the North Elementary School over on Johnson Place. And we used that for the church services and for the Sunday school. We used their schoolrooms for the Sunday school classes. We had a few of our large meetings. Just before that, we had an Easter service, I think it was, in the high school auditorium. But then after we started at North Elementary, we stayed there until we were able to get in our new building. And when we went into the new building, it was like a shell. It wasn't finished inside at all. The building was up. We had concrete floors. We didn't have ceiling tiles at all. It was just all the wiring and everything above us. And this sanctuary, oh, it just seemed so high. In fact, it was like heating all outdoors. That first fall, we started to heat. And our first gas bill got over $400, and at that time, that was shocking. Of course, they're up over $1,200 now, but it was just more than we could handle. So we didn't meet in the sanctuary anymore that year. We went into the fellowship hall, which was easier to heat. And we didn't have pews anyway. We used the folding chairs. And we stayed in there then until in the summer we could use the sanctuary, but really we waited to go back into the sanctuary to use it all the time into 1962 when we finished the inside of the building and all the plastering was in and everything. And that's when we had our consecration service in 1962. April 1st, 1962 is when we had the consecration service. And then it wasn't until we burned off the mortgage in 1973 that we had a dedication service. I guess there's something about you can't dedicate the church until it's paid for. So we had the consecration in 1962 when we really had it finished inside, and so it looked very beautiful.
Why didn't the people decide to reconstruct the burnt structure of the church?
We had known that we would have to enlarge anyway, And we'd been talking about that. It's funny, we'd just been talking about that quite a bit around that time. And then I guess I mentioned before that we had hoped we could buy the property behind us, but we weren't able to. Those people just didn't want to sell. And there just wasn't enough available property right there. And so we had 3 acres of this given to us by members, Mr. and Mrs. Ernest Withers. And another member gave us one more acre, which made 4 acres. And then we bought the property from a Mr. Oswald on the west side of the church. And it had a home on it too, which we still own and rent to people.
Wouldn't you say this fire was suspicious in nature?
It would sound like it, wouldn't it? I mean, in view of what I've been telling you. But, and we used to kind of kid about it, you know. But it really, I can remember a week or so before the fire saying, I smelled something. When I'd come in the hall down below the sanctuary, I'd say, I smell something that smells to me like pine tar soap. I always remember that one from when I was a kid. And it must have been the wiring. It was in the wiring of the organ. And it must have been that. It was kind of smoldering there before that. So it is kind of funny, the timing and everything. I know sometimes I've heard people say from other churches, you sure worked that out just great. You needed money to build a new church, and we got $75,000 for insurance, and we sold the property there for $75,000, and that was a good start on building the new church. And we borrowed from Mahoning Bank at a 5.25% interest loan. Can you imagine that? And they carried us on that all the way through. They didn't ever increase it.
What value did you stress most in your family during this period? Was it hard work, religion, education, or a career?
My family is my daughter and myself. My daughter was just 8 years old when my husband died, and our church was really the center of our life. And while my husband was living too, our church was very important to us, and our religion very important to us. And and it had been in his family and in my family too. They had been Presbyterians and we had been Methodists, but we're the same type of people, and with hard work and religion, and it was important. I know my mother had been a teacher and had gone to college, of course, and it was important to her and my father too that that we go to college. And then it was equally important to me that my daughter would go to college. She became a teacher. She went to Mount Union College and became a teacher. Taught several years, and she'd had it because teaching was mostly discipline. And she went, well, she didn't really go back to school. She went back to school, but she didn't full time. But she worked to get her master's in counseling education. Now she's a counselor in a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center in Pittsburgh, and she loves that kind of work. And education has always been very important to her, too. She still wants to go on and get a doctorate if she can.
after Brother Marston.
What? Want to know about the other ministers?
Yes.
Okay. The next one who came was Reverend John Knox Hess. The John Knox sounds like a Presbyterian, but he was thoroughly Methodist. His father had been a Methodist minister, too. And they lived in a parsonage up here on Massachusetts, too. And they sort of made it bulge because they had 6 kids. And that isn't a very big parsonage. They sort of had them in layers in some of the bedrooms. And they had 4 girls and 2 boys. They were a wonderful family. And he was a very well-loved minister, too. And I think I worked harder while John Knox Hess was there than any of the other ministers. He just was so full of new ideas. He was just full of ideas. And I had to work right with him and everything. And thoroughly enjoyed it. And in those years, I had more energy than probably I have now, too. But they had been here about 2 years, and the congregation wanted to buy them, or put them in a nicer, bigger home, and they really needed it and deserved it. And they came from Coshocton, and they had just moved into a new parsonage there before they came here. So we considered building a home right on the property next to the church there, but it was decided it'd be better not to. So we bought the house over on Shaw Butte, 6664 Shaw Butte. And it is a lovely home. And all the ministers that have lived there since have just thoroughly enjoyed that home. It's adequate and not overly large, but plenty big for any size family, and lovely entertaining space, and a back sun porch that they all have loved, and a nice area. And then he was here 6 years, and Glenn Lockhart came, and he came from Wadsworth, Ohio, and we enjoyed him very much. He was a different type entirely, and I've always said, as I was personally concerned, each of these ministers came along at just the right time in my life. During the last of when Reverend Hess was here is when I had my first knee surgery, and that slowed me down a bit. And then I had other surgery while Reverend Lockhart was here, and he was a very, really pampered me afterwards, you know. And but he was more very relaxed and not as highly organized. Or he didn't have the drive, and but a real sweet personality. We loved him, and very calm. And I think then we worked harder and took the reins a little bit more because of the type of person he is. You know, with each leader, the people react differently, and. He was only here 3 years, so. Then he was moved by the bishop up to Ashtabula, and he's been there ever since. I should maybe, as I went along, I've told you who the bishops were that appointed these ministers. Anyway, it was Bishop Hazen Werner was here at the beginning. At the beginning when Norman Parr and Dean Marston were here in the first years of John Knox Hess was here. And then we got a new bishop, Francis S. Kearns. And then he was here until about 76, 1976, after Glenn Lockhart had left here. And the next minister was Alfred Hubler. And he came from, in the west part of Ohio. I guess I can't tell you. But anyway, he was appointed by Bishop Francis Kearns. And then during the time he was here, we got a new bishop, James S. Thomas. And Al Hubler was very much loved by the people right away. He was younger. And his daughter Lois and his wife Lois and two daughters, Sandy and Barb. He stayed here for 6 years. Then our present minister, Joseph A. Sandeman, came. He was appointed by Bishop Thomas. And he came from Greentown, Ohio, where he had been for 12 years. That's a long time for a Methodist minister to stay in one place. We hope we can keep him 12 years. All the ministers that I have worked for have been wonderful men and have treated me so wonderfully that it's been a real joy. My working in the church has been, how I said, it was kind of a love affair with the people of the church and me. It's just been just very pleasant. And love the people, and they've been so good to me. And I've been treated just great there. I've worked hard and enjoyed it.
Mrs. Epps, can you tell me a little bit about Reverend Santiman and some of his qualities?
Yes, he's, I've loved all the ministers, and I've said sometimes I love each one more, but he's a very special kind of person. He's very, very warm and so full of love. He loves the little tiny babies. He can't keep his hands off them. And the little old ladies adore him, and he's so sweet to them. And anyone who has trouble of any kind, or illness, or death in the family, really appreciate his care. He just is right there with them. He suffers with them. And he understands. And he's Italian and affectionate. And everybody responds affectionately to him. It just brings out the love in people. He just has that natural way. And he's very, very talented in organization. Now he doesn't like anything about the office organization. He's glad to leave that to the administration and leave that to me. But in the administrative board and the Council on Ministries and goal planning and planning for the year ahead and all that sort of thing. He has wonderful talent and abilities in knowing how to do these things. In fact, he's trained in sessions, and he has given lab schools on our organization of Council on Ministry and Administrative Board. And another thing that he is very talented in leading is what are termed bridge building courses. And I've taken one of those courses, and it's a very concentrated, I think it was 33 hours that we took over just a little less than a two-week period. And it's for reaching out and reaching the people who are on the edges of the church, the what they call the dropouts and the drop-ins, and reaching them and learning how to listen and to relate to them. And he is super as a listener, even though he loves to talk as much as I do. We told each other when he first came that we met our match. I think we did. We both like to talk so much. But he is very well qualified for all leadership areas, as well as giving wonderful Sunday sermons, too. Of course, you can tell, I think he's just great all the way around.
What's his involvement with the surrounding churches in Poland?
In Poland, there's a Poland clergy organization that is really quite unique, I think. And he, right from the beginning, is greatly interested in that. And it's the ministers of all the Poland churches, which are quite numerous now. There are Baptist churches and Friends Church and the Lutheran and the Holy Family Catholic Church, as well as the original Presbyterian and Methodist churches. And they meet once a month for breakfast. And they have organized many joint adventures. We still have Thanksgiving services as a community thing, but it's a Thanksgiving Eve service now, and it includes several churches. And we have the World Day of Prayer service. That is a joint service with all the Poland community churches. And this year we started one new one that we think we'll continue with, and that's a Good Friday service at noon. And I think five of the churches joined in on that this year, and that was very good. And then we have an Easter sunrise service that is a joint effort of the churches. And our Vacation Bible School is a joint effort of the churches. And also there's this organization we have now that's called the Poland Intrafaith Council. And that's really the lay people and the ministers in the churches. And that's been very effective. And when there's a need of some kind, this we call it the PIC, is there, and they sponsor the having the blood mobile here twice a year, and they have it at our church because our facilities just happen to be just right for doing that kind of thing, and but the people who work on it are from all the other churches, and a few years ago, we sponsored a Vietnamese family through this Poland Interfaith Council, and all the churches worked on that. So Poland, I really feel that Poland is rather unique in its churches working together that way. You ask me a question, I can go on forever.
What has this present minister done in regards to preparing for the 150th anniversary of the church?
He has set up a task force. I can't tell you who's on it right now, but to begin thinking of the things like this, writing of the history, and what kind of things we'd want to really feature as far as activities when we come to the celebration. And he's rather excited about it himself. One of the suggestions somebody made was that we organize a tour to the Holy Land. And then several of us picked it up and said, well, why not? It would be a wonderful thing, as many of us as could aim toward 1984, taking a trip to the Holy Land. Don't know as we will, but he and his wife had a chance to do that about a year and a half ago. And he's been kind of full of that ever since, too, you know, with the idea of guiding another tour back there.
What would something like this symbolize to the church, the people involved in the church, and yourself?
Well, it just seems to me it would bring it all together. All the things that, just like these interviews have done, and my discussing this with some of the people, of all the things that people remember and bring together, there's something so unifying about remembering. And getting all your memories together and say, remember when we did this and when we did that. And I think that's one of the big things, just the way it unites us. Any big project that we work on unites us that way.
How many members are there to the church presently?
930 right now.
And that constitutes approximately how many families?
There are many one-person families like I am, you know, really. But we usually call it about 500 when we're thinking like a every member canvas or something like that. We think of about 500 families represented. We have large ones and small ones, of course.
And how instrumental do you feel these people will be in this celebration's success?
Well, that's what it will have to be. If it's a success, it will have to be that most of the people really want to do that. We have a wonderful new working group in the church now, which is wonderful for us older people to see. Young couples and young families who are really vitally interested in the church. And I think it will mean a great deal to them, even though they didn't have a part in the history, but to be a part of something that has an ongoing history. And to us who can remember a lot about it, is so important too.
What would you like to see done in regards to preparing for this celebration in order to get all the people involved?
I'd like to I'd like to see a lot of gathering people together in families. Like, of course, I love church family dinners and things like that. They get people together and explaining and sharing ideas about what they'd like to see done and what they'd like to see the church be in the future. And also I'd like to see some good goal setting meetings where people just shout out ideas of all different kinds of ideas that they might express, and then give us a chance to discuss them and see what most of the people like to do. You know.
What role would you say music would play
in Great. This festival? Through the years, we've had a very, very good choir, and other good music too. And our people love good music. And we've had a handbell choir. We don't have one right now, but we have a wonderful set of handbells. And I'd like to see that developed again. And I think our music would be important. A few years ago, we bought a new an Allen Digital Computer Organ in September of 1975. We bought that, and to just show how important music is to the people, we took a loan for 5 years on it. I can't remember the price of the organ now, but it was a goodly price. And people were enough interested in it, we paid it off in 3 years, and because they were glad to have it.
Would you say there's been a slight decline in the members of the congregation due to the social factors that are involved today?
Mm-hmm. And also, what's happened in the Youngstown area. We've lost people. We've lost a number of people, of course, who have had to be relocated. I would hate to say how many families, but some very, very important families to us have had to leave the area. And that was very difficult. And yes, I think young people don't stay in the family church like they used to when they get out and on their own. But of course, so many of them leave town too.
In what respect do you feel does present crisis of ours is jeopardizing your church?
Well, financially, it's a struggle. But, you know, we've always struggled financially. We haven't had moneyed people in our church, but we've had dedicated people. And whenever we've just had to do something, somehow the money come, just like when we had to replace this organ and so forth. People would come forth with the money when we needed it. And our people are a mission-minded church too. We don't have trouble reaching our goals in the outreach department, you know, for benevolences and the world service. Just now, just recently, a Helping Hand Fund has been started to help any of our needy families or needy families in the area. And that has grown like everything immediately. And just a few weeks ago, we had a special appeal for the United Methodist Community Center, which is over in Pearl Street in Youngstown. And they are going to be hurting, especially with all these budget cuts and so forth. And our people were very, very generous in their giving on that one Sunday, you know, to really help out. So when they're appealed to, they can't dig down, even though we never have more than we need to operate on.
How did your church react to the shooting of the Pope?
Oh, I think our people reacted as though he was one of theirs. These things are a terrible blow, and they're a terrible blow to good-thinking, moral people. And we had a special time of prayer for the Pope, and we've been holding him in our prayers ever since.
What are some of the activities that are done by some of the various organizations, vineyards, that are used to raise special funds for special reasons?
Well, now, our United Methodist Men just had an interesting sale. They have it annually, or almost annually. They call it a church mouse sale, but it's like a glorified garage and basement type sale, and they do very well on that. And then at the same time, then the youth put on a bake sale to make some money. And yesterday, to help this Helping Hand Fund, the task force that's working on that put on a snack lunch after church, a beef stew and type meal, and so many of us stayed for that. And the Women's Society, which is called the United Methodist Women now, each year they have a turkey dinner in the fall, and that's a good fundraiser. Some years they have a bazaar with it, and then we have a missions commission that each year does an interesting thing. We hand out dollars to all the people in the church, and they are to multiply them and by crafts or selling things or however they particularly enjoy making money multiply, and then bring it back after 2 months, and we've had different time limits on that. That's been an interesting project. And the youth do a lot of interesting things. They joined in this walkathon last Sunday with the community center, and then we sponsored them so many dollars and a mile, and I guess all of them walked 5 miles. And then they are having a car wash next Saturday, and they sell light bulbs, and they are always thinking of ways to make money for it. Part of their money is to send them all to camps in the summer.
Where do you see your church going in the near future?
I hope it keeps going as it is right now. I just feel that it's really growing right now. I don't mean necessarily in membership or in money or anything, but it's really growing spiritually. You can feel something happening in it. And the minister and I have been discussing that lately. It's just something almost tangible that you can feel, an enthusiasm and a sharing. Our church, I think the people have a real bond between themselves, between each other.
One final question, Mrs. Epp. Is there anything that you want to share with us today that might be of some assistance to this interview?
I can't think.
If not, on behalf of Youngstown State University's Oral History Department and myself, I would like to thank you for your time and your effort. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.